First, now the bridge has arrived, there may be some discipline by impromptu comments from the floor, and they'll all be no doubt appropriate, and they'll be from Reg. It is, it seems to me, in the context of the commemoration or celebration, depending upon your view, in which this seminar takes a part, significant to note that slavery is an attribute of human behaviour, ugly and black in every regard, that was relatively early in the organised international exercise towards prohibition and education. And without going into what are now, I fear to say, the stuff of Hollywood presentations, we are all familiar, I think, from children, from our childhood, with the more or less heroic stories by which slavery in various parts of the world was confronted, first of all denounced as at the very least an inconvenience, secondly pronounced to be at the very least inefficient, and finally to be understood to be out and out an evil which deserved to be forbidden, whether it was efficient or convenient. It has to be said that the bulk of human history has seen slavery as an essential part of most societies. It has to be said that in that regard we are not in the great tradition. And it has to be said that at least in a very small way some self-regard is due to the peoples of many cultures of the last 200 years who have decided in different ways and at different times finally to unite in a way that we saw, I think, most manifest in the 1926 Slavery Convention, very importantly obviously renewed and I think expanded in the 1956 Convention, and of course very much roundly supplied by the international consensus recorded in Article 8 of ICCPR. And that's why we're here. That is, that's why the Commission is here. Because the human rights agenda, by that very expression human rights, is one which in Section 11 of the Commissions Act is at the heart of the functions, expressly so called. Now I'm here because I've been fortunate enough, indeed in my practice I regard it as an out and out privilege, that from time to time I have been asked to appear for the Commission in its applications to be heard on an intervention pursuant to Section 11 of the Act. I regard this as by no means the most important part of the Commission's work, not even my solipsism could achieve those heights, but I do think it is a very important part of what I might call the educational or outreach function of the Commission, and I don't shrink from saying that it involves demonstrating to the High Court, perhaps illustrating for them, the important way in which the administration of human rights jurisprudence goes far beyond the decisions and orders issued by courts such as the High Court itself. I think, from my experience of those interventions, that the High Court is very well aware of that. It's worth noting how special the Commission is with its Section 11 function, quite explicit, to intervene, subject to leave of the court involved, in cases which raise human rights issues, as slavery unquestionably is. The Commission is special in that regard. Very recently I appeared for a land trust in the case involving the Northern Territory intervention. Two legal academics wished to appear in order to put an argument as amicus curiae concerning the nature of property, which, as you might expect, was at the heart of a case concerning the guarantee constitutionally of just terms for the acquisition of property, which was at the heart of the argument concerning the validity of the laws by which the intervention was carried out. The High Court dismissed that application, not peremptorily, but with reasons. And the reasons are such that if I'm were ever to be instructed again by the Commission, I can assure you it would be the subject of an early conference between me and my solicitors. There's the sign perhaps of a new and more rigorous approach to interventions or to applications to be heard amicus curiae. And the touchstone, fortunately, is one which the people I've been very privileged to work with at the Commission in instructing me in a number of cases, including the slavery case, have always had to the forefront of their concern when first briefing me. And that is, what can we, that is the Commission, what can we, the Commission, offer to the court and to the dispute or matter which is before the court beyond that which the parties can be relied upon to argue for their own partisan reasons, in such a way as to add to rather than to obscure the administration of justice? Because please remember that every voice that is heard in a court adds to the time and expense of a proceeding, and at first sight ought not to be welcomed. In our experience thus far, touch wood, I hope this is real wood, so far the Commission has always been welcome and has had a good hearing, and I think we would not be entitled to feel ever that we've been, as it were, ignored. And so I come to the case which is on the agenda for me to talk about tonight. We were most certainly not ignored, and in my opinion this was an excursion by the Commission which has been met with real and substantive advance in the jurisprudence of this country, admittedly on a relatively technical level, but technique is important in the High Court, concerning human rights jurisprudence. The first thing to be said is, of course, that those of you who are nerds like myself will have observed that something in the nature of a new tradition is developing in the High Court. When I say nerds like myself, I mean those unfortunate souls who actually read everything done in and by the High Court more or less as it happens. I don't know how many of us there are. They presumably fit in a room smaller than this, but it is becoming apparent that there is something in the nature of some kind of a courtesy extended to very new judges, and also it would now appear from our case, from a judge in his swan song, to give a set of reasons which are, by separate concurrences, nonetheless isolated and attributed to the judge alone. We've seen that with the last three appointments, and now we seem to have seen it with Murray Gleeson's swan song. And it is, if I may say so, a very affecting swan song. Why do I say that? Well, for a number of reasons. It is Gleesonian in the balance he takes about matters which are at the heart of any human rights concern to identify, prohibit, and watch out for the resurrection of slavery. And he does that by trying to look to the substance of matters, and by finally, in the decision which was called for by the High Court in that case, which is a criminal case, by saying that the evidence was fit to go to the jury, a technical expression which means that people who were not lawyers were entitled to evaluate the material, the facts, and to decide whether it met the legal test in question. In other words, the lawyers were not going to withdraw the matter from the jury. The facts were sufficiently good that, viewed a particular way, which was the jury's prerogative, not the judge's prerogative, it could or might not make out the allegation of slavery. Now, that was a very important step, it seems to me, particularly in relation to human rights jurisprudence. The criminal code in section 270.3, as we all know, more or less enacts. Now, the less is significant, I'll come to that in a moment, but more or less enacts the 1926 treaty. And by that means, Australia has, it seems to me, in the most thoroughgoing and full-blooded way, done what its international obligation requires. We have criminalised the conduct in relation to slavery, which is the object of the treaty to prohibit internationally. And what Chief Justice Gleeson's reasons do, it seems to me, is to look to the substance of the matter in a way which is important for both reasons of substance and reasons of method, and I want to stress method in particular. But as to the reasons of substance, well, in one word it can be summed up. His Honour said it was appropriate for the jury to be looking at matters which in one word, add up to commodification of a human being. And it's a very good word to try to sum up very difficult concepts, because the concepts that are required by the statute by which we have enacted our international obligations in relation to slavery involve the notion of ownership. And if you like, a paradox, which I think Heriot's submissions were successful in exposing as not really a paradox at all, but simply as a stage in history. The paradox is, of course, that in countries like Australia, there are no rights of ownership over any human being. It's impossible to own a human being, and so to talk about rights of ownership is a double absurdity. There can be no right to do that which is illegal or impossible in the law. But the concepts are used in the treaty. And the concepts are used in the definition of slavery, which inform the criminal offence, which is a very serious criminal offence, and let's never let it be forgotten that in this case other human rights were involved, that is the human rights of the accused, to have a sufficiently plain statement of the offence in terms which enable a defence properly to be put, particularly when I think, I'll be corrected if I'm wrong, the maximum sentence is something in the order of 25 years, which in my experience of criminal law ought to be treated by everybody as extremely long, and not long ago would have been the equivalent of a life sentence or longer. Now, commodification, it seemed to me, is a very useful thing for one nation's jurisprudence to have added, as it has, in my opinion, to the international jurisprudence against slavery. Why do I say that? Well, it's because of the technique, the matter of method, to which I was referring earlier. The thing which is really striking about the High Court's decision, and it is, notwithstanding Michael Kirby's dissent on a point not of relevance to these human rights issues, the decision of the High Court, they all agreed in this. The important thing is that without any excuses, without any expression of this being an exceptional case, without any special pleading at all, and even better, without any apologies to Antonin Scalia, Murray Gleeson referred to the jurisprudence of the European Court of Human Rights and the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia as being jurisprudence not only fit to be, but appropriate to be very respectfully considered by the High Court of Australia. Now, I've referred to Justice Scalia quite deliberately. It seems to me he is the exemplar. He's not alone, but he is the self-appointed champion of a particularly sinister strand of jurisprudence internationally, though not in an internationalist way, which sees individual nations' jurisprudence as somehow intellectually to be insulated on patriotic grounds, it would appear, or grounds of exceptionalism that bespeak perceived superiority from the jurisprudence of other countries. And it seems to me that by deeds, not words, the High Court in Weitang has very squarely, and in a way which is most salutary for this country and its legal future, placed this country on the other side of that divide. That we will, in matters of treaty interpretation involving human rights, an area which has been sneered at by people, including Justice Scalia, as being too aspirational to be real law, in this country the High Court has very plainly said it is the proper stuff of jurisprudence. My paraphrase, real judges concern themselves with these matters, and they do so by seeing what other judges in other very serious tribunals seized with the same problems have done in other cultures, whose differences may be observed but whose similarities should be respected. So that it seems to me the treatment of the Kunarik decision from the Yugoslavian forum, the decision of the Ciliadin decision, which comes from France to the European Court, the way in which they are treated by the High Court, are just matters of method, but they are, in my view, perhaps those that have the longer resonance in terms of what may be taken by the Commission and those who support the Commission's work, as I do, from the decision and the reasoning for the decision in Weitang. there are other things that can be taken from the reasons. Those of you who've read it, and I really do commend it, not just because it's the subject of my remarks, but because it is a remarkable case, may I simply flag two paragraphs, as it were, in Justice Haynes' reasons, which are not contrary to Justice Gleeson's reasons. They are complementary, however you spell that word. Paragraphs 137 and 155 are the culminations or departure points, depending how you read His Honour's reasons, for two very important points that I'd like to stress, which seems to me bode very well, in a modest way, for the jurisprudence of human rights in this country. The first thing is something that we, from the Commission and Reg and I as counsel, tried very hard to emphasise in as being the relatively focused contribution of the Commission to the case. And that was that when we come to interpret a criminal statute, municipal law, as the jargon has it, of Australia, which overtly, explicitly seeks to, by its enactment, discharge Australia's obligations under a treaty which is multilateral and which has to do with human rights, then it is critical to privilege a principled, purposive and internationalist approach to the meaning of the relevant concepts. Now, as it happened historically, I'm not going to get this verbatim correct, but in his dry way, Chief Justice Gleeson observes that the travaux préparatoires for the 1926 treaty were not particularly helpful in understanding the meaning of the expression. His Honour was being very kind. I think I can say that between us in our team, we'd read all the travaux, and that's a big book, and they were not merely not helpful, they are bewildering, unless you adopt the approach which now seems secure in the High Court and which I would recommend to anybody caring for their own sanity in dealing with this area of the law. That is, you must see treaties as the outcome textually manifest of political compromises between people who vary in their agendas, their intelligence, their linguistic dexterity and their power. And I stress, and their power. But they die, and their circumstances vanish, and are very often lost, not even retrievable through footnotes. What survives is the text which manifests the compromise. And so, though I don't deprecate the need to explore travaux préparatoires, this is a very good case, a very good illustration of how ultimately they're unrewarding. Different countries had very different views, not only about what slavery might be, particularly bearing in mind that there's a phrase, in all its forms, in all its forms. What an extraordinary expression, designed, having as its evident purpose to encompass the multifarious ways in which people can be wicked against each other. That text was chosen precisely because people could not agree on what all its forms were, and they were going to leave that to be filled by decisions, by local criminal courts probably, from time to time and place to place, and a good thing too. And what Justice Haynes says in paragraph 137 is, in my view, something that needs to be clung to by the Commission in every intervention it proceeds to do for generations to come. And that is that one must understand that in Australia, when we are interpreting either a treaty directly or a treaty indirectly by its linguistic reflection in our statutes, that treaties are not rooted in any particular legal system. That one can probably catalogue all the legal systems that were represented by those who were parties at the negotiations that produced the treaty. You can probably also catalogue, as a taxonomist would, the legal systems of those who later sign on. What you can't do is say that anybody said that that was a universe of the legal systems that could be imagined by those who made this text. Because every country that I know of has, as part of its sovereign power, the capacity utterly to change or radically to alter its own legal system, but still to be bound by the treaties that were entered into generations before. And as time goes on, it's 60 years that are being celebrated at the moment, but as time goes on, that will become a more and more important reality of treaty law and thus of the need to interpret treaty expressions in municipal laws from time to time. They are for different systems at the same time and at different times. And so the words must have some common denominator, highest I would suggest, not lowest, common denominator in terms of the values to be advanced purposively, I stress purposively, according to the Vienna Convention on the Interpretation of Treaties. Second part of Justice Haynes' reasons, paragraph 155, and this one I like as a bit of a bookend to Murray Gleeson's silent or implied reproof of what I'll call the Scalia school of judicial silo. In paragraph 155, one finds a culmination of, or a beginning of, an argument which respectfully draws upon United States jurisprudence about slavery, their constitution, of course, containing extremely important and historically fraught provisions about that terrible condition of humans. And significantly, and without any irony being expressed, though in my respectful opinion much irony being conveyed by the endeavour in hand, His Honour not only draws positively and beneficially for our purposes upon what the United States jurisprudence over a number of years, not only going back into the 19th century but particularly including domestic servant and related abuses of a kind that are very important for slavery, His Honour brings a lot of this down to a very important rhetorical question, which is the last thing I want to say about this case. It has to be said that the definition of slavery is at its most difficult, particularly for a litigant such as the Commission in an intervention role, when one is challenged to provide in sufficiently hard a form to be tolerable in criminal law, that is, to be tolerable as a standard by which people would either go free or go to jail for 25 years, to distinguish between those cases which are slavery and thus an extremely serious crime and those cases which are merely harsh, unconscionable, rude, unfeeling, or even inhumane employment, for which we have another set of laws, none of which I think are particularly serious in their infraction, but all of which have sanctions including appropriate compensation, and some have penalties, some very few have imprisonment as a sanction, but nothing like 25 years. Now that is a real challenge. After all, there are many people, without being facetious, there are many people who are entitled to say that they don't really own their own time, that their employer really does. And let's face it, that's what most of us trade. That's what we can offer in return for remuneration, our time and our full-blooded efforts. Well, one has to be very careful, as Murray Gleeson put it, not to banalise the critical and profound human rights values involved in the international effort against slavery. And it must not become enlisted simply in a very important but quite different endeavour to improve or prevent the abuse of employment relations. It seems to me that that is a very, very difficult area. Well, Justice Haynes offered, it seems to me, something which is very useful and I hope will be one of Australia's contributions to the international jurisprudence in this area. He proposed that one way to test whether what we're talking about is slavery is to turn the question around and ask, of the person, the putative victim, what are they free to do? What are their freedoms? Because as we all know, or those of us with a classical or pseudo-classical education know, there were grades of slaves in Rome. Some slaves in Rome were very powerful individuals. Indeed, some might think it would be terrific if permanent heads of Commonwealth departments could be returned to the state of slave, which is what they more or less were under the early emperors. Now, we have to be very careful when we talk about what we mean by slavery. And it seems to me that what Justice Hayne offered, following on the, in my respectful view, numerous reasons of Chief Justice Gleeson on the main point, what Justice Hayne offers as a very important supplement is something which I think Australia can see as a real contribution, namely, when asking what is slavery as opposed to an abusive employment relation, is the way in to ask, what is the victim free to do? Thank you.